On to item four. Moving right into the substance. Good morning, Mr. Price.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. We've got a couple of agenda items related to the growth part of the portfolio on the agenda today. First of all, welcome to December. I think, you know, it's amazing we're already at the end of the year, but this is a good chance for us to do a little bit of look back at the year that was, and that's largely what we're going to be doing today. We're going to start with the growth sub-portfolio kind of writ large. So this is public equities, private equity, real estate. There's a lot of pieces in here. We're going to go over the structure. We're going to go over market conditions, performance, and that sort of thing. I think the takeaway is it was a good year to be in large cap U.S. equity. It was also a good year for a lot of other risk assets. So provided that you weren't in real estate or China, it was a good year kind of across the board there. So Mitchell walked through that. Once we walk through kind of the whole portfolio, we're going to turn our attention to private equity, what we've done in that space. Brian's going to come and talk about our activity over the past year. We also have Stepstone here who's going to get into market conditions, pacing analysis, that sort of thing. I think that's particularly important when we have this little bit of tension between public and private assets, where Mitch is going to talk about how great the public market was and how booming it was, and yet we're still not seeing the realizations from the private equity portfolio, so there's a little bit of a disconnect there. I think it's important for the trustees to explore that a little bit today. But that's what we've got on the agenda. And with that, you know, three big picture questions, I'm happy to take that. Otherwise, I'm going to turn it over to Mitch to start walking through the presentation here.
If there are no questions of Tim. Good morning, Mitch.
Morning.
Welcome,
Chair.
Happy December.
Yeah, happy December. Good to see you all this morning. I think we have a pretty good story, as Tim kind of summarized there. And we've seen this slide a few times, and this is what makes the portfolio really work. It means that we never have to tap growth for liquidity. We can let it grow, come rain or shine. So that's everything we present today will be net of fees. This is kind of the agenda. We're going to talk about the economy, the portfolio, future drivers of growth, and the projects that we're involved in. Things are really good. All the economic indicators are pretty positive. And the ones that haven't returned to normal, kind of post-pandemic, I believe are normal in the scheme of things. So we'll talk about that a little bit. And I'll give you some figures that will tell you what the averages were for all of these different indicators over the past 55 years. So you get a long view of what things really are. Now, things are so good that now instead of worrying about things being bad, we're worried about things not being good in the future. Right, that's kind of how investors work. There's always something going wrong, and it's too right, so maybe it's going to go wrong. Anyway, the current state here is that we've normalized. This is kind of my thesis, and everyone will agree, but I think I'll try and create some evidence here for you to understand why that's the case. And so what macro factors are near pre-pandemic levels? GDP, unemployment, and inflation. What isn't? It's really the rates. But that's because we were in a period of very unusually low rates for a long time. So here we go through the actual pictures. Here's trend growth. You can see that we're back to trend. Pre-pandemic, GDP was running at about 3%. Now it's at 2.7. The average over the last 55 years is 2.8. So that's pretty solid growth. Should be no problems. If that continues, that's a perfect environment for risk assets. Unemployment, as you can see, went up to 15%. Now we're at 4.1, but pre-pandemic it was 3.6, which is really unusually low. The average over the last 55 years is 6. And, you know, when I was in school, full employment was considered 5% unemployment. So that's a pretty good number, too. Inflation. This is CPI, and we're going to go through the details on this in a second, but obviously it really ramped up, 9.1%. And now it is back to 2.6, the average over the last 55 years, 4%. This is why people got so upset. The red line is CPI. You can see that it jumped way up. The blue line is PCE, which is what the inflation gauge for the Fed. And you can see what I've been tracking and thinking things are pretty good is that real earnings, That white line is above both of those. So that should be super positive. But during the 22-23 period, we had this huge ramp in CPI, and it's really because it's so skewed to shelter. And, you know, that hurts people. And that's why there was so much negative sentiment. Here we have the policy, monetary policy, Fed funds, obviously went way up. It's arguably too restrictive. And this morning we had CPI that came in at 2.7, and the probability of a cut in December went up from like 70% to 95%. So that one's kind of is done. So this type of the spread was close to zero at one point, and now it's 75 basis points. There should be a wider spread here. We expect to see Fed funds come down and potentially the 10-year move up a bit. And remember, the 10-year is basically driven by two things, growth and inflation. If growth is good, the 10-year should be higher, right? If inflation is a little bit higher, it should be higher too. Here's the Treasury curve. It's now it's moved up a little bit since we put this out. It's probably about 12 basis points between twos and tens in terms of steepness, which is a curve that is normalizing. You can see that the kind of khaki-colored line, that's where we were a year ago, highly inverted and not normal by any means. That's just the Fed fighting inflation. And then we move on to consumer confidence. This is like this is not a 50-year view. This is normalized from 1985. We're moving back to essentially the average. We're at 111 today, and the average over this time period is 110. Pandemic took us to 86. This is what people worry about, is just, you know, how much we've moved in terms of valuations. And remember, valuations are based on a few things. It's partially just the multiple we apply and also how much we have in EPS growth. So those are the things we're going to talk about. Now, you can see that there's two differences here. The white line is the SPX, which includes everybody. Market weight. And so that's the Magnificent Seven, which is 37% of the market today in terms of market weight. And the SPW is an equally weighted measure. So there's no skew to the Magnificent Seven, which, you know, is Amazon, Apple, et cetera. So here's kind of the cold water here, and that is the amount of debt the U.S. has. You can see it's really growing faster than GDP. That's not a good look. But remember, we spent like $5 trillion during the pandemic, and probably close to $2 trillion of that supported households who were in need. And we maintained unemployment at a reasonable, we got unemployment back to a reasonable level pretty quickly. So, you know, you can look at that as we got to do something about this, and we do, but maybe it was for the right reasons. This is the thing that, everything's going so well, how can it continue to go well? And if you think about, this is from Research Affiliates, and they're the team that runs one of our emerging market equity funds. This is earnings growth, real earnings growth, and the 10-year subsequent real returns. And what happens is if you have really high earnings growth, real earnings growth, subsequent returns are not that great. And that's the gold star that you see. Well, that's where we are today. We're well above, like, in the 90th percentile in terms of EPS growth. And you can't continue to grow forever, right? But I guess the good news here is that if you look at the dispersion around that regression line, there's a lot of dots that are positive. There's a few less dots that are negative. But what you would expect, given the history of this type of data set, is that we're going to have close to zero nominal returns and maybe negative real returns. And that's not a view that's completely out of sync with a lot of different broker dealers. Goldman Sachs came out with like a 3% return over the next 10 years to U.S. equity, which is pretty abysmal. Others are more optimistic. But this is half the picture in terms of how we value equities, and that's EPS growth. The other quarter is probably the multiple. The other quarter is dividends. So let's talk about our kind of growth outlook. Oh, maybe I'll just back up a bit. I ran this analysis this morning. So what's really skewing the PEs on the Magnificent Seven is Tesla. The number is 183. The average for the S&P today is 25. The average for the Magnificent without Tesla is 38, 55 with it. And if you take out Tesla in terms of the PEG ratio on the Magnificent Seven is actually kind of reasonable. It's below the average for the S&P 500. So what's the PEG ratio? It's how you value the earnings given the amount of growth that analysts expect to see in EPS. So long as we stay on this growth trajectory, they're kind of reasonably priced, at least some of them. So this is kind of a review of what's changed year over year. And I think this is still the same story. I mean, things have somewhat normalized, right? You look at consumer sentiment, it's moved up. Disposable income has moved up. Unemployment has been reduced significantly from the high. It's moved up a little bit over the last year, but it's not a number that really causes much concern. The big deal was a couple of years ago was that if we got to an elevated ratio, elevated number that was 50 basis points above the average, this was somehow going to produce a recession. The recession predictions just haven't happened. And, you know, my view of the whole economic state right here is that between the federal government and the Federal Reserve, they pretty much got this right. I mean, when you think about where we were a couple of years ago and now where we are today, this is a pretty, like, this is kind of sticking the landing, so to speak. You know, they really did a great job. I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but going from 15% unemployment to 4 and 9% inflation to 2.5 is pretty phenomenal, and maintaining growth at the same time. This is the global market returns. You can see 22 was a pretty bad year. The only thing that really did anything was, real estate and commodities. This year, the only thing we're really seeing that's negative, as Tim mentioned, is, you know, China, real estate, and commodities. The other numbers are pretty phenomenal. Now, if you look at the 32% return for the S&P 500, that half of that is the Magnificent Seven, because they're 37% of the market cap today. They started the year at 25%. So that shows you the growth. This is a very busy slide. Sorry for that. But again, it's just kind of showing you that the recession that most broker-dealers and economists saw coming didn't happen. We maintained growth. And the one thing that's a little odd about this is that forecast for 2024, that's more of a baked number. That's not really a forecast anymore, because we're in December and we've got the numbers. So basically, everything went kind of the way you'd expect in terms of what was expected earlier in the year. We had PC, you know, inflation was in line, employment was in line. They were a little bit elevated, and that's what pushed the 10-year up.
Question.
Yeah.
So in terms of normalization and talking about what's normal or what's not, when I think about the Magnificent Seven, it strikes me that that's just fraught with risk, right? You have so much concentrated in seven companies, the leader of which is now going to, you know, head our Department of Government Efficiency, or co-chair it. Is there a reference point in at least more recent history, meaning the last 50, 70 years, that where you had that kind of concentration? I mean, like when I was growing up, I remember Big Blue, right? You had IBM, yep. You had big stalwarts like that. But I don't remember anything like this. At least it's not coming to mind.
No, you're right. It's really a good question and something we're thinking about quite a bit. It's never been this concentrated. I think the only time you saw something kind of like this, I'm not absolutely certain about this, was the, quote, Nifty 50, which included Big Blue. That was in the late 60s. And it's not a good look, right? If you think about it, you say, I'm going to own seven stocks. I mean, you know, just from basic financial theory, that's not a good way to go. I think, you know, modern portfolio theory says you need 30 stocks to be diversified, and if close to 40% of your market is seven stocks, somebody stumbles, that's not good, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's no margin, right, for error.
Yeah, it's not good. It's a very high concentration, you're right to point it out. It's one of the things that, in terms of headwinds, I was going to mention. But so you're a little bit ahead of the game. But it's absolutely true. I mean, it's the biggest worry, right? And when you look at something like Tesla's 183 times earnings, it's a car. I think it's just a car company. I don't know. Maybe it's something else.
The latest thing I saw floating around the internet is a series of pictures of Teslas that are in various places. Now, these aren't date-coded photos, so I see this stuff in real time and look at it and wonder about it. But it was a series of photos of storage lots. I mean, I'm talking about hundreds of acres, that maybe thousands of acres of cars, all Teslas. And the point was, they're unsold. And, that's now, is that accurate? I don't know. It was on the internet, so I figured it was true. But, it was... No, they weren't. Oh, no, they weren't. They hadn't been driven yet. That's, or else, there might have been a healthy percentage. But
I think Tesla is 3 cents also.
I'm not sure.
No, there's no cross-holding.
It's owned by...
Same guy, but there's no cross-holding between the two. So there's no SpaceX holdings that are embedded in the Tesla stock price. But, I think the more important thing is, yes, Tesla is just... eye-wateringly expensive, but NVIDIA is producing really strong earnings, and they actually look like relatively reasonably valued company. Apple, Meta, I mean, these are expensive stocks, but they're not eye-wateringly expensive relative to the earnings that they're posting right now. So I think the more important thing would be to say, yes, Tesla might have a valuation issue, but the others, like, unless we see an impairment coming to their earnings growth, they're trading at reasonable valuations. It's expensive, but it's reasonable relative to the incredible earnings they're producing. So,
just like Apple, the rate of growth when you look at that chart, right? I don't know how many times it's doubled in the last 8 years.
Yeah,
probably three, maybe. It's like crazy.
It is. I think the. The analogy I go back to is probably more the breakup of the oil companies 100 years ago, where you had such concentration in a couple of companies there, and they had to be broken up. That regulatory risk, I think, is lessened with the new administration coming in here. But anytime you get a company that large, that dominant, the risk is you have an action from the U.S. government to break those companies up.
Well, even Kroger and Albertsons couldn't get it done, right? Yeah. So that I thought that was interesting news.
Yep.
There's some hope, I guess.
But this
I didn't mean to get you off track.
No, that's okay. I mean, there's only so many cars you can sell on the earth, right?
Well, I just don't know when we talk about normalization,
Well, let's put it in context. Yeah. I'm talking about normalization in terms of the economic indicators. Let's start there, right? Because we came from a period of really high volatility where we had high unemployment, low GDP. It was the country was kind of a mess, and the world was as well. So from that and rates were very low. And now we're in a position where we can see a trajectory towards growth. We can see a trajectory towards lower unemployment. And we have normalized rates, a rate curve that actually makes sense. So that's the environment that we sit in. What happens to valuations? That's your question, and I agree with you. I mean, things are so good, how can they keep getting better, right?
Well, the bubble burst problem, right, or the failure of one or two in that scenario, it seems like things will unravel. At least that's the feeling.
Yeah, a bad day for NVIDIA or Tesla is a bad day for the stock market at this point. Any one of those guys has a bad day. You see it immediately. So concentration is definitely a risk. It's not a good look for forward returns. It's one of the risks.
So be it. Well, anyway, I got you off the
No, it's a really important question, and I'm glad you raised it.
Mitch, before you leave this era, you talked about earnings earlier on. Earnings are frequently described in two forms from a company, GAAP and effectively non-GAAP. Which earnings go into this pool that we then measure against?
Good accounting question. You know, I mean, GAAP earnings are full of, the reason there are analysts on Wall Street is because GAAP earnings don't represent cash flow, right? So every good equity analyst gets out the financial statements and reduces those GAAP earnings to cash flow and comes up with an EBITDA multiple. That's what really drives value. But as you know, I mean, these are GAAP earnings. You know, just to let you know, that's true. And they can be manipulated, right? They can be manipulated by a variety of things. And that's a pretty lengthy discussion.
One classic example is whether you recognize a cost for stock options. I think from an accounting point of view, it's pretty clear there is a cost. They do have value. But from on the other side, there are an awful lot of particularly high-tech firms that don't recognize a cost.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm not that familiar with that particular part of GAAP, but I mean, it is a real question, right? And I guess the one thing to put it in context is we're talking about historical levels. It's been the same measurement for many, many years, right? I mean, GAAP changes a little bit, but I think fundamentally it's the same over
the
last.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really just kind of a historical context. I guess the other thing we could say about this state of the economy is that at least all these Magnificent Seven really have earnings compared to the dot-com era where you had people who just had eyeballs on screens and sales and no earnings, right? So we have that going for us, and I think but it's the growth trajectory that's difficult to project. And if that doesn't happen, they're not going to be worth what they are today. So that's the risk.
All right. I don't see any other questions, so go ahead.
Okay. So asset allocation, performance, and risk return versus benchmarks and forecasts. The asset allocation is definitely very much in flux right now because we changed things in July, and we have some room to catch up on various things. You can just think about what do we have on here? Real estate credit, we haven't done anything, but our long-term target is 3%. So it's going to be, and the same thing with multi-asset credit, it's 4%. We're working on those. Chi-Chi's working on the real estate part. I'm working on the multi-asset credit. We have, in multi-asset credit, we have quite a few really well-positioned firms that we're looking at today. This is kind of a quick slide, but I mean, it just kind of shows you the trajectory of our returns to growth over the past 6 years and 7 years. And it's not anything you don't know. We had a tough year in 2022, but I think it does represent something that's important to this group. And that is you have to stay invested. You have a bad year. You have to stay invested. And we've made up everything we lost in 2022. Here are the returns by asset classes. Growth is doing what it's supposed to do. Domestic equity has been kind of the winner here, along with private equity. They're kind of neck and neck. Private credit has done well. And, you know, that's the one thing on the private side. Private credit just pays you a coupon, right? It's an income producer. It's not a total rate of return, really. It's not going to provide that much capital appreciation. But our book produces something like 11-12%. Interest, you know, so that is a very good, you know, and that's a growing piece of the portfolio. We took it from 10-13%, so I think that's a good story. Risk parity, not so great. It's not part of the portfolio anymore. Any questions on this before I move on? Because this is the whole portfolio. Okay. This is kind of goes to show you that returns are mean reverting, right? So we can't predict what's going to happen next year, but capital market assumptions actually work out pretty well on an average basis over a 10-year period. So, and you know what's interesting here too is that the initial valuation over a 10-year period is pretty significant. So if we're at a 25 PE or a 30 PE or whatever, that's a very significant portion. It's up to 50% of what you're going to get over the next 10 years. But in the short term, it's not very indicative. So in 6 years or less, it's less than 30% of the explained returns. I think the thing I point out here is that we're at 8.9 versus 8.8, which is, I'm not going to crow too much about being above by, you know, 10 basis points, but we're on track. Headwinds. Okay, what's missing from here is that concentration. And I thought about that kind of afterwards. But the first thing is just global physical activism and policy. So we know that in this country, the incoming administration wants to lower taxes, wants to do some deficit spending, and change the regulatory environment. Those are all stimulative and potentially inflationary. Does that mean that we're in trouble? It doesn't necessarily mean that, because we have the history of the country where you have higher than average inflation and really good growth, and that's great for risk assets. So, you know, that would be kind of the Reagan era, would be an example of that. Rates are higher. I think everybody thinks rates are going to stay higher for a while, and I think that's probably a good thing. We do think the Fed has room to cut, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But, you know, higher base rates, all else being equal, are just going to are going to make asset returns converge. So fixed income gets a bump, and everything else that's kind of valued based on cash flows is going to go down, right? All else being equal. Again, we're starting at a very high rate in terms of the PE. And, you know, are we going to get a 10% return on it? We're going to get a 10% growth rate in earnings next year? Well, the average is 6. So maybe, maybe not. If the Magnificent Seven keeps moving, if we get a movement that broadens the market performance, that could help too, right? So there's a lot of companies that really haven't benefited yet from higher multiples, and that's potentially going to happen. We're going to have a broadening of the performance returns. Tailwinds, there's really room to cut. Looking at kind of how you come up with Fed policy over the last 20 years, you don't really see it very often where the Fed is kind of obviously restrictive. We have at least 75 to 100 basis points that we can cut here. If you look at just what goes into their calculation, it's very obvious that inflation is lower and growth combined with inflation creates an environment where we can go 75 to 100 basis points lower. The macro conditions and regulatory conditions continue to support growth for the Mag 7. There was... the FTC was looking at Chrome and wanted to kind of do some kind of regulatory action there. I don't think that's going to go anywhere. When it was announced, Google dropped a considerable amount that day, and it's gained it all back. So I think the market's basically saying that's not going to happen. I think the regulatory environment with the incoming administration is pretty benign. In fact, it's supportive of risk assets. The equity risk premium is where it is, largely because of where rates are. Initial valuations, and I think I already talked about this, 50% 10 years out, that's what initial valuations actually predict. And then finally, we have just the enormous amount of technical innovation in this country that's driving valuations. If you talk to people outside, you know, like in Europe, they kind of come here and we've got it all, right? We've got amazing stuff in terms of technology. It's really driving the global economy. That's my view, and I think it's shared by quite a few others.
What about, so let me just stop you there for a second. So the European economy, every time I read something, it seems to be in the tank, just to use that phrase. Whether it be the British economy, the EU, it seems to be in a downward trending, and it's been there, right? But that's how it comes across when you read just the popular media and you know some of the more enlightened reporting, it strikes me that, that place is in trouble to some degree.
Yeah, it's been a tough environment. It doesn't get the same multiple as, you know, the U.S. companies. They have demographic problems. It's not a united regulatory front, really. There's differences between countries that make it more difficult. Obviously, there was Brexit. It's just not a as dynamic an environment. And, of course, kind of one of the big engines of growth there is Germany, and they've had their issues, right? I mean, they're not getting cheap energy from Russia anymore. They have energy issues. Their ability to sell luxury goods into China is somewhat diminished. The automobile industry is not humming along the way it has been in the past. That's a big driver of growth. So, you know, when you think about who's doing things in pharmaceuticals, who's doing things in semiconductors and tech, it's not happening in Europe. I mean, some of it is. They do have companies that do that, but it's really based here. And, you know, that those types of things, AI right now is just kind of, it's just the picks and shovels, right? But eventually, people are going to be using it to look through depositions and write summaries, and it's going to change the way we do work here in this country.
Well, they're doing some of that now. I mean, you know, some of that type of work, routine business communications, are often now AI-generated. But you're right, it's just scratching the surface in terms of the potential.
The
prior slide, it's interesting that ahead, so the uncertainty, I know we're still in the party phase of the change in administration, and there's some kind of, it seems to me, sort of you know, inexplicable, enthusiasm, right, that's embedded in, like, the recent market activity. But isn't there a headwind we could identify with potential? I know there's regulatory changes. The deregulation in some areas is being championed and is being reflected in a lot of stock movement. But there's also the whole issue of tariffs. If people think that things are going to cost less in the future, that maybe they're deluding themselves. I mean, doesn't that factor in somewhere?
Well, first, we don't know what's really going to happen. You know, there's talk and then there's what happens. But I agree. I mean, tariffs are inflationary, right? And if you go too far in stimulation, if you keep lowering taxes and you stimulate all this growth, that's going to create inflation as well. So if inflation genie gets out of the bottle, that's tough, right? And I think John Phillips brought this up before. It's like, how much is too much debt? If you keep, you know, if you lower taxes and you don't get the growth, then you're going to get more debt, right? And when does that actually create a problem? And it creates a problem when people lose faith that you're going to pay them back, right? And when inflation goes higher, that's going to drive rates up. And that could kind of, if you had an inflationary spiral that drives rates back up, And I'm not just talking about what the Fed does. I'm talking about the long end of the curve, right? Because the Fed only controls the short end. The market controls the 10-year. And so the market might just say, hey, if you've got an inflation at 2.5 and I can see it going to 3.5, I need to get paid more on that 10-year. And that's going to drive up mortgage rates. That's going to create higher, you know, the future cash flows will be discounted at a higher rate. So they'll be worth less, and that just means all risk assets are going to be worth less. So, yeah, that's we don't know what's going to happen there, but it's definitely could be an issue. You know, I agree.
It'll be interesting to see when we talk again in March or April, whenever that is, after the, you know, the party, the first part of the party's over. We'll see what happens.
I think your analogy is apt. I mean, it's very clearly, you know, the market is responding to a perceived lighter regulatory environment and pushing up valuations. Tariffs could end that quickly, particularly with the concentration in the S&P 500. And, you know, this goes to the, you know, why we pound the table about diversification, which has been a challenge when you've had seven stocks kind of leading the globe in terms of their earnings. But the more concentrated it is, the more risk that there could be an exogenous shock. It certainly levying tariffs is an exogenous shock on the system, that it's really not priced in today. It'd be one of the components that changes, but this is why we spread our bets and, you know, why we invest in Europe, even though in Europe writ large, you don't go passive into Europe. You don't just buy the market, but there are individual companies there. Novo Nordisk has had an incredible year with the GLP-1 drugs. You know, there's been a lot of infrastructure built out there, but you have to kind of pick and choose, and I think that's where our positioning in, you know, using active management to go into those markets makes a lot of sense.
I just noticed something in my notes I think is kind of interesting. So I mentioned earlier that Goldman Sachs has a 3% return to equity over the next 10 years, pretty low. If you didn't have the concentration risk, they ran the same analysis, and they came out with a 7% return. So that's how they view the concentration. Yeah, it's pretty significant.
Plateau with respect to their own.
No, it's taking them out of the picture. It's saying, what if we just start at a valuation without them being valued where they are?
Right. Yeah, it would be higher.
You're
saying with the Mag 7, it would be 3%?
With the Mag 7, they say 3%. Without, it's 7. And that's because this is based on the thought that the valuation that you have today is about 50% of your future returns. So if your valuation is in the 90th percentile, you're going to have all else equal, you're going to have lower returns in the future. But if you drop it down to, say, 50, which is probably maybe where it is if you take out the Magnificent 7, then you have higher returns in the future. Is that make sense?
Yeah. If one of the nice things about rates being where they've been is for our fixed income, right?
Absolutely.
Kind of the foundations for our returns and what supports our ability to pay pensions has been improved with the higher rates in the fixed income. We haven't had a sense that we've had to chase yield as much when we were when we were getting 1% on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So with rates coming down, does that change the mindset of the investment team with how to balance that with going into higher earning investments that can keep us at above 6.75 on our assumption rate?
Well, let's just break it down a little bit. So first off, we think that the terminal rate, which is the Fed rate, is going to drop. Maybe it's like 4.75 today. Maybe it goes to 3.75, maybe 3.5. And that is look at that and think about it in terms of our private credit. And so what that is, when you invest in private credit, you get a base rate plus a spread, right? So because a lot of the different groups that we're involved with are in lower middle market, they're still getting a large spread, right? So the gross asset yield is not going to come down that much. So maybe you go from 12 to 11. So that's not too impactful. That's just kind of a, you know, blue skying it here. That's about what it would be. And then in terms of other, like if you have longer dated paper, that's not coming down. Right? The long end of the curve is not going to come down that much. That's my view, and I think that's the view of many. And it's a more normalized curve, right? If you have 4.75 on the Fed funds rate and you have 4.25 on the 10-year, that's not a normal look, right? So there's room to cut. That's going to come down, you're right, and it's going to have an impact. Probably the biggest impact it'll have might be on the liquidity portfolio, because there you have short duration, 1 to 5 year, but there is some duration there, so it's not going to be down at 3.5, right? It'll be more like 4%. Today I think we're getting a little bit over 5 on the liquidity portfolio on average. So, and then there's a lot of different ways to play that particular asset class, right? So in terms of private credit, we're not going to just stay within direct lending. We have other ways of expressing our views there, and we're working on that as we speak. And we can optimize that portfolio across at least five different asset classes, including direct lending, where we recently explored asset-backed lending, and we made a commitment there. And we're looking at CLO, mezz, and equity as another option. So that's going to prop up those returns there. And then in terms on the public side, away from liquidity, we have the multi-asset credit allocation, which we're working on today. And there, we are also looking for managers who can deploy across a series of assets, right? We don't want somebody to get in and say, okay, we're going to do nothing but levered loans. We're going to do nothing but high yield. We want managers who can pivot and say, I want to be in asset backed. I want to be in CMBS. Whatever makes the most relative value sense is where they're going to be. And we're looking at those potential managers for their ability to pivot when things change, because these markets are obviously not static. So while your point is absolutely correct, lower rates are going to take things down all else equal, but I don't think it's going to be that significant. And I think most of the market has a consensus that rates will be higher longer, and that we're returning to a more normalized rate curve and a more normalized rate environment.
Mitch, I had one follow-on question on one of your responses to David, and I never heard this before. Goldman Sachs, 3%, 6%, 3% under our current configuration without the 7, 6%. That's incredible. The question I had is, what if we look back 10 years, what would it have been without the 7 versus what it actually was?
Yeah, that's maybe a question for further research. I don't think I have an answer to that.
Only if you had it in the top of your head. But my guess is it went the other way. That is, the 7 raised the net return.
Oh yeah. I think that's absolutely
true. A reasonably substantial amount.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're talking about reversing, or Goldman Sachs is, talking about reversing that going forward.
Yeah, I didn't understand your question at first fully, but that's absolutely true. Nobody predicted where we are with large cap U.S. equities. No one predicted that.
That earnings growth has been so incredible and stable and over an extended period of time, which is causing us to be nervous today and trying to diversify around that.
Yeah.
But, hindsight's 2020, and 10 years ago, had we bought 7 stocks and just rode that would have been tremendous. It also probably would have been a violation of fiduciary duty to be that concentrated in that few number of stocks. So,
yeah. Ain't that the truth?
I know.
Who knew? Yeah.
So this is kind of the wrap up here. What are we doing in the next 12 months? Obviously, continue to build out the private market allocation. The private equity piece will be Brian and Stepstone will tell you about that. In terms of the private credit piece, I can tell you that we have this new platform, Burgess Caissa, and getting all the data to be accurate has been a little bit of a challenge, but I think we're there. But what's more interesting is our ability to optimize the portfolio and use different modules within that software to do that. And in as much as we're going to be talking about the Treasury allocation in January, and we've been using Burgess to run different scenarios and figure out how we can optimize that return within the risk diversifying portfolio, we're doing the same thing on multi-asset credit, and we're doing it in private credit as well. So right now, we're very heavily into direct lending in private credit. It's probably 90% of the portfolio. We want to build that out so that we have regulatory capital in there. We have CLOs in there. We have asset-backed, and we have real estate. We have a little bit of real estate and a little bit of regulatory capital, but we can build that out and create a more diversified and more stable cash flow return. So that's a good thing. We're kind of excited about using this new tool. we're going to build out multi-asset credit. That's probably sometime mid-year next year. and the public debt research is ongoing. Chi-Chi's working on that. That's probably third quarter 2025. So with that, any further questions?
And let's see if might be tapped out. Looks like everybody's asked what they wanted to ask. So thank you, Mitch.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was good to hear the news on Burgas Caiza. That's good that that's being integrated and useful.
As we know, big technology projects are a little bit of a bear, but we're getting there. So,
yes.
Thankfully,
yes.
This one's much simpler than our other one.
Yes, they are. All right.